home of the truth.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
Well, I was in Atlanta last night. I watched Ohio State celebrate. Confetti everywhere. College football season now 215 days away. But what happens between now and then is a lot of hand-wringing, some lawsuits, Title IX, some things, you know, if I keep talking about it, you're going to get bored with. House versus the NCAA, lawyers, billable hours, all of that stuff. Our next guest, Daniel Libet, is at Sportico. He does a great job covering some of that stuff and making it easily digestible for the rest of us. He is joining us now. Do you consider that one of your jobs, like to kind of be like the encyclopedia guy, but you gotta make it relatable?
I suppose. It was funny when you were just saying that all of the things you just listed as being boring, maybe to most, are the only things about college sports I think I've come to care about now. So I think there is a convergence, though, of these kind of technical and somewhat esoteric concerns about college sports and fans, because I think everybody has now realized that their experience of watching or enjoying college sports really is going to be defined by things that happen in the courtroom and so forth. So, but yeah, I'm happy to try to make it as relatable as possible.
Yeah, help us out with this one, Daniel, because this story broke in the last week or so. Xavier Lucas, he's at Wisconsin, and then he's not at Wisconsin, and he didn't go through the portal. He just got in a car or got on a plane and went to Miami and enrolled at Miami, yep. And his agent and everybody are saying, hey, this is legal. Help us understand what happened, how it went down, what it means to the rest of college athletics right now.
Yeah, well, I think we're all going to find out together. I mean, one of the things that we've been living in and for years now, I mean, arguably decades, but let's just talk about the last 4 years since when NIL went into effect, is we're all living through a funhouse mirror experience of what the rules are. Everybody is sort of winking and nodding and pretending as if certain rules still apply. They're challenging at the same time very aggressively other cornerstone rules of the NCAA and of amateurism, and so we're kind of in this betwixt and between era of college sports where it really is up to people and in many cases the courts to figure out, all right, what is actually applicable, which of these rules that the NCAA has on its books comply with federal and state law, and so we're 100 and some odd years into college athletics, college football, and we're just beginning to really get to the to how much of the stuff is legal and permissible and so forth. So in this case with Xavier Lucas, he is challenging the whole concept of the transfer portal. And this, do you actually have to enter the transfer portal in order to transfer to another school? This has been accepted as a fiat, as a foregone conclusion. No one else has dared try. Certainly athletes have transferred to other institutions if they've decided to give up playing sports or if they've dropped down outside of Division I. But this is not that. This is a FBS to FBS transfer without the portal. And it goes back to the question of this agreement that Lucas signed with the University of Wisconsin. Like many athletes are now signing with their schools, these are kind of revenue share agreements in waiting. These are memorandums of understanding or memorandums of agreement that schools have been handing out to their athletes over the last number of months in the expectation that the House, the NCAA settlement will pass, that revenue share sharing with players will take place next academic year. And this is to sort of line it up, even though we haven't quite reached the point where this is all permissible. And so number of cases with the Big Ten and other conferences, the conferences have distributed language to their schools as just kind of templates of what these forms or agreements should look like. And so Xavier signed an agreement with Wisconsin, according to both sides, that the school says bound him to continue to play at the university. And Xavier and his attorney, Darren Heitner, who's an outspoken sports lawyer from Florida, are saying, nope, we're not bound by this. And also, we are not bound by having to seek your permission to enter the transfer portal after the school denied his request to enter the transfer portal. They just went ahead and enrolled in Miami with the expectation to be there for the fall 2025 semester. So Wisconsin has more or less suggested that it will sue the player, sue Miami for alleged tampering. The NCAA, in a public statement, sort of tacitly supported the idea that that Lucas could transfer without the portal because of other antitrust lawsuits that are currently pending, challenging whether or not the portal is even legal, or the restrictions on transfer are even legal. So that's where we are now, with a big bunch of questions that are not resolved.
I am watching this. And, you know, I had people ask me, you know, can athletes transfer in mid-year? No, they can't. NCAA's got a rule that says, hey, you can only play at one school in this academic or in this calendar year or academic year. So you're not going to see guys at halftime switching sides. But if it turns out the portal isn't, you know, that you don't need the portal to do what this athlete did in going to Miami, what does it mean to schools that are, you know, looking for the NCAA and looking for the portal to create some structure? Is this just another step in your mind, Daniel, toward collective bargaining? And this is one more thing that is going to be on the table?
I think so. I mean, there's a group of kind of screaming advocates right now who are saying, look, regardless of whether or not you like it or not, it would be easier for everyone, more seamless ultimately, if you establish a kind of collective bargaining arrangement where you sign athletes to contracts, where you treat them as employees if you don't treat them exactly as employees, precisely because then each one of these points of tension don't ultimately have to be litigated. I mean, then it just appeals to kind of basic contract law. But until then, all of this stuff is up for debate. Does this violate federal antitrust statutes with each one of these provisions that the NCAA has in place? And, you know, I mean, we're living in a moment now where, you know, this enterprise of college sports has grown into this multi-billion dollar business, despite violating, you know, kind of across the board, antitrust law. And now it's trying to put the genie back in the bottle, or at least rearrange it in such a way that it complies with antitrust laws. You know, there's obviously the NCAA and schools are appealing to Congress to create some sort of catch-all legislation that will give it its breathing room to allow the House settlement to play out, to stop all of this litigation and future litigation. But I think we just keep returning back to the same premise, which is, the easiest way might be the hardest pill for everyone to swallow, and that is to collectively bargain in a way where then you can just look at what's been bargained for. Then you might not have to deal with the sort of epidemic of transferring in college sports, because there will be contractually agreed to commitments between athletes and schools. But again, the NCAA, the powers that be in college sports, have been extremely reluctant to yield to this position, even though the minds of many legal experts, economists, player advocates, and so forth, this is where it's ultimately going to end up anyway. It'll end up with collective bargaining.
We're talking to Daniel Libet of Sportico, covers the business of college athletics, among other things. Daniel, this memo of understanding between the athlete and the school at Wisconsin, have you had eyes on any of those memos? How binding are they? Apparently, in this case, with the Wisconsin player, the player doesn't think it's that binding. But have you had eyes on those agreements?
Well, I have. This is my understanding. I can't confirm this, but our understanding, based on reporting, is I have seen a copy of another Big Ten school's memorandum of understanding with one of their players. And our understanding is that this is the common template language. Maybe there's a few tweaks. Obviously, the name of the school is changed, and maybe some small fine points, but that this is substantially similar to what many Big Ten schools are using, and probably is substantially similar to what the agreement that Lucas signed with Wisconsin. And this is a fairly thorough one. You know, the Big 12, as I understand, the SEC, the Pac-12, these conferences, the conference offices have each kind of provided their members some sort of guidance, if it's in the form of a draft or if it's in the form of something else. This is pretty extensive. This is 7 pages. You know, when you think about a memorandum of understanding or a term sheet, you're usually thinking about a one pager with some bullet points. That's more or less of getting the idea down. This reads like a contract. This reads like a fully executed contract. It gets very in detail. The part of it that wasn't shared with me, and it wouldn't have been relevant in Lucas's case, is each one of these then contains an addendum where you actually see what the terms of the deal are spelled out, the financial considerations and so forth. But even just the legal language is very interesting. And this one is interesting in a couple of ways. One, how despite a number of components that really make it seem like an employment agreement, it explicitly states in several different places that this is not an employment agreement. And the same, even though there's elements of this that very much make it seem as if it's conditioned on player performance, it says this is not a pay-for-play agreement. At the same time, it enables these Big Ten athletes or Big Ten future athletes, it enables the schools to change the financial considerations based on the performance of the players. So again, this just gets back to the fundamental irony, the fundamental paradox we all live in, which is, you know, if it's NIL and the way that athletes are being paid as inducements, but it's being pretended as if they're being paid purely for endorsements, or if it's an agreement such as this, it's a lot of saying one thing where everybody who's party to the deal and everybody in the space realizes it's something else. And this really came into stark relief in the memorandum of understanding.
I have spoken with the attorneys representing more than 30 University of Oregon female athletes who are suing as part of a class action lawsuit. They are suing. It's a Title IX lawsuit. It's an NIL lawsuit. You had some recent reporting. U.S. Department of Education has come out with a position on NIL saying, hey, it should be subject to Title IX. What's going on with that, Daniel? Is this some posturing? Is it pre-President Trump rhetoric? What's going on?
Yeah, well, it might be all of those things. So the Department of Education in the waning days of the Biden administration put out a whole bunch of different, just like many of Biden's agencies or the agencies under Biden, put out many different positions. The Department of Justice weighed in the House case, kind of challenged whether or not the settlement was kosher with antitrust laws. And similarly, the Department of Education, civil rights enforcement arm, Title IX arm, put out this long-awaited memo. People have been waiting for this for 3-4 years, which basically addresses the question of whether or not NIL and NIL payments and by extension revenue sharing is held to the same standard as other resources given to athletes under Title IX. Because if it is, then the plan to pay in future considerations, or in the House case, as back pay, the billions of dollars in back pay, which is really going towards football and men's basketball players, 90%+ of it, that wouldn't fly. At least it wouldn't fly under Title IX, or at least it would be complicated by Title IX. So, yes, you pointed this out. The one lawsuit so far prior to this that has actually, the one Title IX lawsuit on the books that has actually tried to address NIL is the one filed by former beach volleyball players and crew athletes, female crew athletes at Oregon. And the attorney there, the lawyers representing those athletes, felt that this, even if this opinion by the Department of Education's Civil Rights Division is not legally binding, and even though that the new Trump administration can either reverse it, ignore it, amend it, that they felt that this gave their position a lot of support. Now, again, it's up to judges ultimately to make this determination. So how swayed the federal judge overseeing the Oregon case is, or how swayed Judge Claudia Wilkins, who is overseeing the House case, is by this, is the question in terms of its significance. But it definitely points out that there are some real challenges in even reconciling federal law with other federal law when it applies to college sports. There's certainly a belief among certain people that football and men's basketball players whose sports generate by far the preponderance of revenue should be treated fairly along those lines and deserve to enjoy greater NIL and revenue sharing than any number of other athletes whose sports don't do that. But then again, college sports, you know, exists under this law, unlike pro sports. There's no Title IX for pro sports. There is Title IX for public, you know, as it relates to college athletics. And those two issues are also going to have to be reconciled. And inevitably, if not in the Congress, then in the courts.
And let me ask you this, Daniel, because people are pointing to this lawsuit in Oregon. Is it true that universities, other states, lawyers in other states, athletes in other states are waiting to see what happens with this case in Oregon? Will it set precedent?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, just because, one, it's a federal case, so it would be precedential everywhere. It's not just, you know, this is, I mean, Title IX is a federal law, so you have to file it in federal court. And yeah, so it would matter. Now, again, you know, it would presumably, whatever the ruling is, it would presumably be appealed. But even the specter of it holding sway at the end of the day, the specter that NIL has to adhere to Title IX could be as significant as what the ultimate ruling or appellate ruling is in the case. Schools have to try to come up with a long-term solution of their own, of how they're going to distribute money, how they're going to provide NIL resources. And, you know, presumably you're thinking not just 1 year at a time, you're thinking 5, 10, 20 years out. And so, again, just the idea that depending on the administration, depending on the judge, depending on the makeup of certain appellate or the Supreme Court, that there might be this expectation that Title IX really does govern NIL and house revenue monies and so forth. Schools are going to presumably keep that in mind as they chart their plans going forward and make their bets on the future.
I've got about a minute left here. Again, if you're interested in this stuff, and you should be, if you're a college sports fan, Daniel Libet with Sportico, at Daniel Libet on Twitter. Daniel, you know, I'm waiting to see what's going to happen with NIL and this, you know, the revenue sharing that schools are going to do. I hear some schools talking about combining NIL in their revenue sharing. Others saying we're going to keep it separate. Can you, if we're on an elevator, easily explain that to listeners who step onto the elevator and are getting off the elevator in two or three floors?
Yeah, I mean, simply put, there's still much more money, even if the House settlement is approved. There's still going to be a lot more money for certain kinds of athletes available in the NIL space. And so that's the challenge. The challenge is how to figure out how to continue to pull those levers to pay your football and men's basketball and maybe women's basketball in some cases, athletes, millions of dollars more than they will be able to get under the cap of the House revenue sharing. And so do you internalize that in the athletic department? Do you let NIL continue to exist on its own so that it's not under certain kinds of restrictions? That is the question all the schools out there, and at least the FBS level, are weighing right now, because obviously in this competitive landscape, they want to have the flexibility to offer as much to at least certain of their athletes as they possibly can.
Daniel Libet, Sportico. Hey, I appreciate you, man. This is important stuff. We're all interested in what is happening in college athletics, and keep doing what you're doing. You're doing some great work.
Always nice to talk to you. Thanks for having me.
There he is from Sportico. keep an eye on that lawsuit at Oregon. Beach volleyball players, club athletes suing Oregon, class action lawsuit, could cause some Title IX tentacles. And we're all, does the portal matter? Kid from Wisconsin says, doesn't matter. NCAA goes, yeah, he's actually right. Like, why would you even get in the portal now? You don't need permission from your school. Just go do what you want to do. NCAA says, it can't stop you. Leave it here. Some parting thoughts coming up. You got the bald-faced truth.